we have maybe 1,100 employees across four countries, four totally separate cultures. You can have anything you want, but you can't have everything you want.
Hi, folks. This is Abe Shreve. Welcome to the Choose Difficult podcast. The path to success is not easy. Here we explore the stories of those who choose difficult and change the world they live in. Today, we're coming to you from beautiful Ogden, Utah, and the voice you've just heard comes from a legend in the music industry. That was Bob Taylor, founding partner of Taylor Guitars. Now, if you play an instrument, especially if you play the guitar, you've heard of Taylor Guitars. They're one of the largest manufacturers of guitars in the world today, and they are the go-to musical instrument of some of the most well-known recording artists in the history of music. People like Neil Young, Christopher Cross, Neil Diamond, George Strait, Prince played a Taylor guitar, Zac Brown, Jason Mraz, Dave Matthews, Taylor Swift, the list goes on and on. It's a huge company, over 1,100 employees across four countries, but that's not how it started. Like so many success stories, Bob got his start in very humble beginnings. I want you to join me in 1972. Bob Taylor's 18 years old. He's working in his very first guitar job for a company called American Dream. 2 years later, in 1974, the owner of that shop decides to go in a different direction. Now, Bob gets with his friend Kurt Listug, and they convince the owner to sell them the business. And Taylor Guitars was born. They took on a third partner in the beginning. And the name Taylor Guitars was chosen because Taylor was the right look for a name on the headstock of the guitar. I recently read Bob's book. It's called Guitar Lessons, and it chronicles the story of those early beginnings, including Bob's childhood and his inquisitive nature, and takes you all the way through his memoirs into 2011 when the book was published. Today, we pick up the story at a time in the history of Taylor Guitars where most companies really hit the whitewater. What I was really interested in learning from Bob was, how did you go from a company that started with just three of you to a company that now employs over 1,100? How did you go from a company that just produces one guitar a day to one that today produces over 750 guitars? How do you do that? So one of the challenges that faces business owners as their business starts to grow is this idea that you can have a passion that you can have something that you're truly passionate about. You can be really passionate about guitars, about building guitars, about people playing your guitars. But that passion doesn't mean you're also going to be good at the business of your business. And specifically, just because you're good at producing your particular widget doesn't mean you're good at leading others in your business. And Taylor Guitars is no exception. Bob told me that he and Kurt, right around the 45 employee mark, got together in an empty warehouse space and made this incredible discovery so many of us come to at some point in our leadership career. In Bob's own words, he said, basically, we suck.
During those years that Kurt and I got a consultant, we went into an empty building with an empty office that had like HVAC hanging from the ceiling. We got three chairs, sat in a triangle circle, and for 48 hours, we didn't come out. And during that time, we thought, we suck. If we're having employee problems, it's not employee problems, it's employer problems. We're the ones that suck at this. We don't know how to take care of employees. So we made ourselves a plan. We referred to that all the time. And it had like top tier goals and middle tier goals and projects and things that were gonna, and every time we started, a good idea came up that we thought, hey, that would be great. We would measure it against that and go, that'll be great one day, but it has nothing to do with this plan that we put in place. We made that plan on purpose and we're sticking to it. And we learned how to be good employers. Now we have maybe 1,100 employees across four countries, four totally separate cultures. And I'd say we do a pretty good job of it.
I want to make sure that you caught Bob's last point. It's super critical. Most entrepreneurs are driven by internal passion, but both Bob and Kurt realized at some point they needed to add the leverage of structure. And that structure came in the form of a master plan. This master plan is something that they would refer back to all throughout the rest of Bob's career. It was the thing that would keep them from chasing all the great possible ideas and keeping them focused on the ideas that mattered the very most. It was also something that others could look to and be led by. In fact, it wasn't just merely a plan for the business. It was a plan that additional leaders could lead to. And leadership is not just something that you're born with. It's something to be learned, studied, and cultivated over time.
When I was 12 years old, adults would listen to me. Leaders are leaders when they're young. They're leading people in mischief. They're leading people in good things. You can learn to be a leader if you practice. The practice has got to be not degrading yourself, but realizing I just made something, it's not good. Or we just did something and it's not good. We didn't do a good job.
Yeah.
I didn't do a good job. We didn't do a good job, right? Mm-hmm. And if a person can do that, you can say, now how could we do that better?
It really comes down to the delicate balance of doing our work the best it can be done while keeping a narrow focus on our master plan. Not getting lost in all the things we could do, but actually staying focused on a plan that we know would work.
You can have anything you want, but you can't have everything you want. Life is
Stop.
A series of
Stop. Choices. Did you hear what he just said? Here it is again.
You can have anything you want, but you can't have everything you want.
If you didn't write down that little nugget of gold, you're missing it.
Life is a series of choices. You trade your money for an education. You trade working for a person for your time, or maybe working for yourself. You know, oh yeah, you can start a business if you want, but you might not get paid. So you can have anything you want, anything. Don't complain to me, because you can have anything you want. But you can't have everything you want.
Along the way to becoming one of the largest and most recognized guitar manufacturing companies in the world, Bob realized that he isn't going to be in that driver's seat forever. At some point, he's got to replace himself as visionary and head leader. Bob knew that he had a lifetime's worth of ideas in terms of innovation and continued creativity in guitar building. Bob also knew that he wasn't going to always be the person in the driver's seat. But how do you replace the man whose vision launched the company? How do you replace the man that created all of those innovations in the world of guitar playing? You needed a special person who not only understood the instrument at its most fundamental and elemental level, but he also understood the end user. He understood what was needed to bring joy to the person holding that Taylor guitar. So Bob did what many of us do. He sat down and started to make a list of attributes he believed would be mission critical for choosing his successor.
So I wrote this. Dear God, I need one guitar maker who, colon, is a good person and can make a commitment for life, who is a pro player, who could play on stage with anybody, anytime, at the spur of the moment. Why? Because that's going to be his ticket into, like, this artist world. Who never worked for a guitar company, only worked for themselves, because they need to be born to do it. Like they needed to be born to do it, like I was born to do it. Somebody who worked for me is going to try and carry on in my tradition. That's not what I wanted. I want someone that would make a new tradition that's better than my tradition. Who knows the deep history of guitars, which I don't know at all. When I started making guitars, I thought it was an original thing. I'd never heard of any other guitars except a Yamaha and a Ventura guitar. I didn't know about Martin, Gibson, Fender, Guild. I didn't know about any of them. Who, get this, has 20 years of experience and is less than 30 years old. Put that up on monster.com. I literally wrote these things. It's clear as a bell. I threw the piece of paper away. I should never have thrown that piece of paper away. Who's from San Diego? People are like, that doesn't make sense. If there was a good guitar builder, he could be from anywhere. It's like, no, because San Diego has a culture. And I just put that in my drawer. I'm telling you, it was 5 years later that we were at a trade show. Jason Mraz was playing at our show. I went back into this little green room we have to talk with Jason. Hey, Jason, how you doing? And this, he's like, hey, this is my friend Andy Powers. He's plays guitar with me a lot. And Andy's dad was there. Hey, I'm Chuck Powers. I'm Andy's dad. I go, we met you when Andy was 17. We were at a Harvey Reed concert at MiraCosta College. We sat behind you, and Andy asked you a whole lot of questions about building ukuleles. I go, I remember you two guys. And that literally was the last time I'd seen Andy. And then I thought, Andy Powers, oh, you're that guy I keep hearing about that makes really good archtops. You're up in Oceanside. He goes, yeah, that's me. Well, so we were well met, a little reacquainted. I came home. I started thinking about Andy, and literally 3 days later, I was sitting in a stoplight on the way to work, and I thought about Andy, and I saw that list come up in my mind, and I knew that I could check every box. He made his first guitar when he was 7. He was 28 years old the day that I checked those boxes. He's from San Diego. He's the best guitar builder I ever met. I looked at his guitars. They were unbelievable. He knows deep history. Every single thing on that thing was met. I'm going to just say one last thing about the list. If I had not made that list didn't cause him to be born. That list didn't cause him to say yes. That list caused me to recognize him when I saw him.
So Bob called Andy and asked if he would come and join him for lunch. And while they were at lunch, Bob started to ask Andy some really interesting questions.
Andy, can you name the guitar builder at, and I named all the other guitar companies that are big. Can you name the guitar builder at so-and-so? No. How about so-and-so? Nope. Then I mentioned some small companies. Can you name the guitar builder at Collings Guitars? Yeah, Bill Collings. How about Larrivé Guitars? Johnny Larrivé. Taylor Guitars? You. And I said, well, Andy, I don't ever want to have a guitar company who you can't name the guitar builder. And I don't want to relay what I think God's plan is for you, but I think that there's a chance that you were born to take Taylor Guitars. And he's like, really? He had an incredible musical career going at that time, and he was building guitars. He started out when he was 7. By the time he was 12 years old, the IRS caught up with him and said, you're making too much money. You have to figure out how to sign up and become a real person. On our way home from lunch, I said, so what's your initial reaction? And his answer was, well, primarily I want to be the man God wants me to be, and I want to be a good husband to my wife, and where exactly I make guitars isn't the most important thing to me. He began to think about it. The convincing thing that I told him is, Andy, you get to make your talent. You can make 12 musicians a year happy because that's how many guitars you make. With us, you could change the state of the art of guitars, make hundreds of thousands of people happy, and absolutely leave the whole industry of guitars in better shape than you found them. And I said, let me put it this way. Kurt and I, we built a foundation that doesn't crumble, and we built a roof that doesn't leak, and you get to decorate the inside because there's more than a lifetime's worth of work to build out what Taylor Guitars was meant to be.
Bob told me that the most important thing that has happened at Taylor Guitars in the last 10 years was hiring Andy Powers. And when people say to Bob, well, you were the one that made that decision, he says, yeah, that's true. But really just sit back and watch him work. It's just an absolute pleasure to see him work. Bob has experienced a lot of joy watching Andy really claim his position as the visionary and the leader of Taylor Guitars. So what do you do if you're Bob? What do you do if you're a guy that for his entire life hasn't stopped really to take a break? It's not like this guy can shut off his ideas. It's not like he can just slow down. He's known as an innovator in the world of guitar building, but it is so much bigger than that. Now that Andy was in place, he was well known, he was running the company, and Bob had 100% trust in him. He could see the future of Taylor Guitars flourishing under his new leader. It gave him space to continue to invest in an area of his industry that doesn't get a lot of attention: the environment. These guitars are made out of rare hardwoods. We know how to cut them down. We know how to go get them. But what are we doing as an industry to replenish that valuable resource?
The ebony business was rife with shadiness or downright illegality. Now, a company came into existence that had a sawmill. I partnered with a supplier and colleague of ours in Spain. We went in together and bought it. After a year of investigating, literally talk about the 11th hour, it was 11:30 at night, and the next day we're signing the papers, and my would-be partner, Bidal, said, "Bob, I can't go through with this. There's too much wrong with it." So I went over across the hall to his hotel room, and I said, "Look, Bidal, we can bail on this, but you'll never be able to sell ebony as long as you live, and I'll never be able to use it because we can't unsee what we've seen. We can't unknow what we know. Everything about this is illegal, and there's nothing we can do about it other than buy this illegal thing and make it legal." So we did that, and then that worked its way into planting and a lot of things like that. And so we own the largest ebony mill. We just completed planting 15,000 new ebony trees. We have a method of doing that. I've started a program that's called the Ebony Project, and that's being done through a new institute called Congo Basin Institute. I'm teamed up with UCLA. They provide the science. We're writing the bibliography on that wood because for 3,000 years, people have known how to cut it, but not one person knows how to grow it. In the next 10 years that you see, and in fact, even now, anything that you see written about ebony of any substantial girth is what we've added to it. And Wow. And we've got 5 scientific papers ready for publication. Also started a business in Hawaii for COA. And then we've moved around the world, making sure that the places that we do business are very community-based, completely legal, protecting the forest.
Bob recognized that in order to continue his business, he had to get involved in protecting these precious resources, these rare hardwoods. However, because the vision was big, because the vision was more than Bob, because it exceeded just his local market, because they had spent all of those years leaning into the discomfort of their challenges, because of all that, Taylor Guitars became major players in renewing these precious resources. Now, there's a principle in business called strategic giving. The idea behind it is that you want to be a company, not only do you provide a great service or a great product, and not only do you provide a great customer experience, but people want to be associated with a company that does good. Not just creates good things, but actually does good things. So this principle of strategic giving allows others, both inside the company and outside the company, to be part of a bigger cause than just creating profits to the bottom line. Maybe even without knowing it, Bob created an incredible, scalable opportunity for strategic giving because each one of the areas that he has purchased a sawmill, that he has gone in and partnered to create and replant forests of ebony and koa, any of these places, he has also created ideal working conditions, both for the people that work there and their families. And many of these places like Cameroon in Africa are known for their incredible corrupt politicians and leaders who actually take the money. And so doing things the way Bob's doing it, he's able to ensure that the employees that work at those sawmills, the employees that are involved in planting those trees, make a great wage, and that their families are taken care of, and that the legacy moves on. And the legacy has now morphed from building the world's greatest guitars to planting trees, which sounds simple, but there's a lot more to it than that.
Planting trees? Who doesn't like planting a tree? And so what's interesting is because we combine guitars with environmentalism, National Geographic will do an article on Taylor Guitars because of the both. Rolling Stone will never, ever, ever do a story on Taylor Guitars. It's too commercial to them. But you add environmentalism and then Rolling Stone does it, or BBC, or Forbes. The amazing thing is that U.S. Forest Service has a foreign division, and everywhere we go now, they follow us. If we go to Fiji, they come right there. If we go to Guatemala, they come there. And as a matter of fact, I was asked to write a letter of recommendation for the U.S. Forest Service to receive their funding. Wow. Now, that's kind of an interesting thing. We're not a big company. We're a small company. I hired Scott Paul to be our director of natural resource sustainability, and he was director of Greenpeace Forest Campaign 14 years, right? So I hired the best person to come in there, and he knows a lot. And Scott likes to say, oh, no, Bob, I can do more for the environment here than I could at Greenpeace. He goes, I absolutely guarantee you, because it's guitars are connected to it, and the work we're doing is great. And he likes to say we punch above our weight. It's one reason why we stay a little apolitical. Sometimes people, what do you want to know about this or that or the other thing? It's like, what I know is red states and blue states love guitars, and Taylor Guitars can keep doing its thing that it does for people, for the environment, for employees, for vendors, for foreign countries. No matter what, you're going to do somebody some good. And the fact is that everybody is serving as an example. You're serving as an example, whether you know it or not. So it's going to be a good example or a bad example. And we have a little bit of reach, and we like to serve as a good example. And so January of 2019, there was the convention, World Annual Meeting in Kuala Lumpur of the Society for Conservation Biologists. These are 4,000 people strong. They're the most up-to-date leading biologists of all the countries and NGOs of the world. They come together, and they had me be a keynote speaker, and I believe that I was the first businessman to ever speak, because they think business is the enemy. That's their long-standing point of view. So because of the work that we're doing in Cameroon and Hawaii, and with Urban Woods now, we're starting to make guitars out of trees that were cut down from LA city streets when the city decides to remove them. And we're using that timber source now that doesn't even come from a forest. They invited me to show them what a business could do. And it was like open arms. And we are really used to being the enemy. But business doesn't have to be the enemy.
I hope you're starting to identify a very important pattern in the way that Bob lives and leads. And the pattern can most aptly be described this way. Bob created a vision so big that it could not be fulfilled by him alone or his partner, and could not even be fulfilled in this lifetime. In fact, it has no end cap, this vision. It started with guitars in a small garage shop, and it built into one of the largest manufacturers of guitars in the world, but then it extended to these incredible environmental efforts and sawmills and overseas, employing thousands of people. Now, a lot of companies get off the ground, and a lot of companies hit momentum, and then they stall. You may have experienced that in your business. Bob certainly experienced that in his business. There were multiple times that he hit real challenges. Imagine being an acoustic guitar maker in the 1980s when the popular music of the day made the electric guitar more popular than the acoustic guitar. I mean, that's the kind of challenge that puts companies like Bob's out of business. Those with a vision big enough to see them through lean into the discomfort of the heavy lifting and learn, and they just do the work that's required to get through it. And so, what is it that kept Bob from selling his company? Why is Bob still involved now that he has enough money and enough success that he can just sail away into the sunset? Well, the truth is, for real entrepreneurs, they're never done. In fact, it's not done for the money. It's done for the purpose. And Bob's no exception to that. In fact, he shared with me an analogy he learned in a book he read early in his career that described why he continued on even when his business felt just completely difficult.
I had read a book about the history of San Diego, and people came from back east. They homesteaded a little place. It wore them out and they left. And the second owner came, bought the property from them. But there was already a well. There was already a hut, a little log cabin. There was already, you know, a few fruit trees, and then it burned them out. But the third owner had success because of the work that had gone on before them. And there was about three times when I wanted to just like sell this company. One of the things that kept me in business was I couldn't bear the thought of running into someone at the grocery store and them saying, so how's that guitar thing going? And I would have to say, well, I had to quit that. Every time I thought of that, it was so abhorrent to me. I couldn't handle it. I couldn't handle having to say those words to somebody, so I just got back to my bench and worked. And then the other thing that I thought was, I want to be the third owner. Because I'd read that book early on, maybe around my 10th year of business, and it was about the area where I was living and where we were working. And I thought, I don't want someone to work off of all the work, the sweat equity I put in.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed getting to know Bob Taylor just a little bit. I absolutely love the time that I spent with him. And there's no question that Bob is someone who really exemplifies the call to choose difficult. There were a few things that really stood out to me in my conversations with Bob that I just wanted to leave kind of in the highlight realm. One of them is that there comes a point in a business where you have to stop working long enough to really cast a big vision. You have to cast a vision that will help serve to organize the efforts of the company. And that vision has to be so big that it can't be accomplished by you, the current people at the company. Not even in your lifetime, it can't be accomplished. Part of the reason it's critical to have a big vision is if you want to attract truly talented people into your world, you have to have a vision big enough to encapsulate their vision. And Bob and Kurt are no exception to that. They cast a vision so big that it couldn't be achieved by them in their lifetime. Taylor Guitars certainly lives on, and when it faces challenges, it's able to overcome them because they are led by this incredible vision and purpose. I loved how Bob talked about that they realized that they sucked at leading people. I don't think leadership is something that you can learn without failing. You have to fail. And it's the only way to do it. You can read all the books in the world. You can attend classes. But until you've hired someone you were unprepared to lead, and you felt the pain of not being prepared and even losing that talented person, I don't think you're learning the lessons required to be a person to really lead high-octane, talented people. I love how he said, we realized we didn't have employee problems. We had employer problems. That self-awareness is so important. In my experience as a business coach, over 10,000 coaching calls, there have been many times I've seen business owners that blame their people. But the ones that have the most success with others, working through others and leveraging through others, are those that look in before they point out. Bob's a great example of that. And finally, what I loved about my conversations with Bob and what I gained from his book is hard times will come. You're gonna face them. They're coming. There's always something you can do. And that certainly was true for Bob. It's certainly been true here in our company. We have a big vision. We lean heavily into how we lead our people. We use models and systems to do it. And hard times come. And when they do, there's always something that can be done. Well, there you have it, folks. I hope you've enjoyed our time together. And I hope you'll join us next time as we continue to explore the stories of the extraordinary individuals who choose difficult.